Hey everyone, this is Jennifer.
And this is Paige, and this is Big Book Energy.
Welcome back to our last episode of season 3.
For real this time.
Kind of a bonus episode, yeah. It's actually the end of season 3 now. This was the cursed, forgotten episode of February.
Yeah, it was back. Our original fourth episode in our main series. And then my computer became sentient and apparently hated what I said and ate our audio.
Ate it. Just ate it. Disappeared. Gone. We didn't have time to re-record at the time, so here we are at the very end of the season, at the end of May, and we're finally bringing you The Tiger's Daughter. Here you are. It's happening. I know everyone was just falling over themselves with anticipation for this episode.
Right. I mean, I certainly was not.
Okay. Yeah, I was a little distracted at the start of recording today because I'm going to turn a 2-second story into a long story. So I subscribe to Smithsonian Magazine email newsletter.
Very nice.
I would definitely recommend it if you are like me and like art, history, science stuff. The newsletter basically puts together a bunch of, I think it's just like the regular like articles / blog posts that are on Smithsonian Magazine, and it puts them together into a little list. I don't get it daily. You can get it daily, and I found that that just like clogged up my inbox like horribly. Mm-hmm. So I get like the weekender, but it actually sends it to me like every like 3 days or something. I don't know. It's not once a week. I don't know why. But yeah, so I subscribe to Smithsonian Magazine newsletter, not Smithsonian Magazine. I was scrolling through a article today on the Irish elk, you know, as you do.
As you do.
I can't remember its scientific name off the top of my head. Let's see. Oh, yes. Megaloceros giganteus. It had the largest antlers of any known deer. They had a span of 12 feet, which is just insane. And the antlers themselves weighed about 90 pounds, and the males weighed about 1,500 pounds total, which is the approximate size of the moose, the American moose.
Oof.
So these guys were big, and these antlers were huge. And what's really interesting about this is that cave drawings of deer-like figures with these hugely exaggerated antlers, up until Megaloceros was discovered, fossils of it were discovered, we basically thought that these people were just imagining something that didn't exist. But it turns out that this was actually anatomically accurate drawings of a species that we didn't know existed. So that's really cool, right? Well, actually, there was an ad. There was an ad on article that I was reading, and it's for the Smithsonian, like the National History Museum's new exhibit called Deep Time. It's their new fossil exhibit. I was looking at pictures of it. It looks gorgeous and amazing. And I was like, you know what? I want to go there. So then I was looking at flight prices from Portland to Washington, D.C. And they're like fucking $200 round trip right now. And so then I was like called Morgan in. I'm like, what would you think about just like flying to Washington, D.C. for a couple of days? So I can go to the museums. That's the funny thing. I don't even care about like going to see the White House. I don't even care about that. I just want to go to the Smithsonian.
Same. That's just it. Same. Just leave me alone in the Smithsonian for like 4 days. I'll be fine.
I just need a few days to go look at some of the museums, you know. Mm-hmm. But then he was like, well, why don't we drive? And I'm like, it's like an 8.5-hour drive. And he's like, well, we could make stops. So now we've like turned a few days in Washington, D.C. into like a full-on road trip. And so we literally had that conversation. Then you texted me, I'm ready to record now. And I was like, oh, I need to switch gears now. So I'm still thinking about this trip. Like we were talking about like New York City, Washington, D.C., like Boston, Philadelphia. Because those are all like, you know, on the same path that we would have to take. Mm-hmm. And it sounds amazing, but it also sounds expensive. So we'll have to see if this pans out. But I really want to go see Deep Time. Basically, this is just a giant PSA for the Smithsonian and their awesome new exhibit, which sounds like it was just made for me. And it really does make me wish that I could be working in museums right now because I would love to do this kind of thing. Like putting together a fossil exhibit? Like, are you kidding? Oh,
hell yeah. Hell yeah.
That sounds amazing.
It does.
But, you know, I also like hate people. Like, I don't like interacting with people. So what kind of job? Can I just be like a museum storage gremlin? Like, I just live in the back, you know?
A collections manager?
Yeah. Like, I just live in the back and I don't have to talk to anyone.
Right. Someone comes and finds me and be like, we want this in the exhibit. I got you.
You're like, okay, this, I know where that is.
Yeah. I get that.
I certainly don't want to have to, like, interact with school children in any way, in any capacity. And that's like half of being in a museum is museum education. So like, I'm very interested in like exhibit design, like how to present information so that people can get the most out of an exhibit. Like, that interests me. So that is also pedagogical in nature, but like actually having to like do the teaching with the kids. I'm just like, I don't really want to do that. So yeah, everyone go see the Smithsonian. Go check out the exhibit. It's called Deep Time. And also Megaloceros, an enormous elk. It actually wasn't an elk. That's a misnomer. It's actually a deer. So. And it's huge.
That sounds awesome.
And you can get it in Animal Crossing. So. So it's a fossil in Animal Crossing. Another reason why Animal Crossing is amazing.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent, excellent.
Yeah, so I feel like I've talked enough. I don't know if you have any updates for today.
No, not really.
You're just getting ready to flee the country.
Yeah, basically I'm just fighting with banks right now. Because no one wants to issue a student loan to go to Iceland, so everything is awesome. How is anyone
supposed to pay for that? Why wouldn't they? I don't...
I have no answers for you. It has been a struggle. It has been a really long, drawn-out process, and I'm ready to flip a table.
Understandable.
Yeah.
I'm just, like, has the program had other people from the United States?
I think I was looking at the roster for last year, and I'd say half of them were from the U.S.
So then how did they pay for it? Do they have money? Are they wealthy? So.
From what I have heard, I'm not the first person who's coming in from another career. I'm just one who has not been paid very well, so I have no savings.
Oh, God. Just another instance of our work biting us in the ass.
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, God. Anyway, yeah.
Let's get into some mythology. Yay.
Let's do it.
All right, so mythology section. So this has been quite the experience trying to research Mongolian mythology, which after a reread of this book is probably more relevant than Chinese mythology. What made this such a challenge was first my complete unfamiliarity with Mongolian myths. Literally my first exposure
nothing.
To it.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing. But also there seems to be some inconsistency. I'm not entirely sure what caused this, but I have a few suggestions for you. One, mythology is just often inconsistent. It changes over time and space. We've seen that over and over again. Second, the Mongolian tradition is oral, and therefore some things may have changed over many tellings. And third, one source I looked into mentioned some aspects of Mongolian tradition have been destroyed. For example, during the oppression of various communist regimes in the area. So let us go into this with the understanding that I am no expert, and am fairly confused about this topic myself. This religion is known as Tengrism, named after the main god Tengri, who is the sky god. It's also known as Mongolian shamanism, has been practiced by Mongolian and Turkic peoples, and is still practiced in modern-day Mongolia, Turkey, Russia, China, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. So Tengri, as I mentioned, is the main god, the father sky figure, if you like. And he is the one who creates humans and animals. In one myth I saw, he was a flying bird continuously over the water endlessly until someone shouted at him to create land, which he does because he's lonely. Others don't mention him becoming a bird, but tasking a bird with bringing up mud from the bottom of the water to create land. Honestly, I'm not sure what's what here. Yet another myth says that it isn't Tengri at all, but his son Ulgin, who is the creator god, but these two occasionally get merged together. This actually makes some sense, since I've seen some myths mentioning Mother Earth and others mentioning Erlik, who is the brother of the creator god, so Tengri and Ogin being separate makes sense. Erlik is the god of death and the underworld, and he is not happy about humans, so he spits on them, which causes disease and sickness. Also just gross, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Nice dude.
Nice, nice. Also, he has demons. Interestingly, what I saw suggests that he and his demons aren't necessarily evil. Balance is very important in this religion, so evil or unfortunate events or deeds or beings are kind of part of what makes the world work. Everything can't just be good. This doesn't stop people from sacrificing to Erlik in times of sickness, so there's still that. Okay, next up are the three realms within this religion. The upper world, the middle world, and the lower world. The upper world is inhabited by demigods, both good and what I would label as bad, but not evil. The middle level is our level, and the lower one is not exactly hell, but definitely not as nice as our world. In the upper world, it's super bright with 7 suns and 7 moons, and the lower world is dark with only half of a sun and half of a moon. Interestingly, you can't see anyone from other realms, so that does actually come up in the story that we're reading today, so keep that in mind. If you want to communicate with another level, then you have to have the help of a shaman. Why would you want to do that? Which is a fair question. Apparently, sometimes part of your soul may end up in the lower world, and the shaman can help you get it back. I wasn't entirely sure why that happens, but it's nice to know that can be reversed. Soul splitting doesn't seem high up on my to-do list.
No. Just saying. I'm also curious, like, what they would have interpreted as a split soul. Like, what kind of conditions?
Right? Yeah, is that like a code for mental health or something?
Yeah, because like depression or schizophrenia, yeah. Or
yeah, that was my first question, but unfortunately I didn't really see anything as to what this condition entailed. But you know, if that fits within it and somebody of Mongolian descent wants to write that book, I will 100% read it. It seems very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Also, animals in nature are very important to this religion. When you die, your soul goes back to nature, so protecting the environment is extremely important.
We love to see it.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. As for animals, they were also created by the creator god and can act as protectors. Wolves, for example, are related to Genghis Khan as sort of guardians, I believe. Interestingly, when I was looking up Mongolian myth folk tales of animals were the first results that I found, so extremely important. Mm. Also, horses are obviously extremely important in Mongolian everything.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It makes complete sense. So I'll link to some websites that I found if you want to check them out. And this is where I want to end this overly brief explanation of Mongolian mythology. It's not terribly relevant to the story that we're reading. It certainly takes elements of Mongolian culture and mythology, but it's not necessarily like a complete parallel that we've seen in other works. So
right, like it's taking a known story and like reworking it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll leave it there and we'll be heading on to Paige Presents Fun with Comics.
Let's go. All right. So today we are especially having the hindsight of looking back across the season and the different comics that I have highlighted. We're going to do a quick change of pace. We're going to get something a little more lighthearted this week, and that is the webtoon Down to Earth. All right, so the synopsis for Down to Earth. Cade lives his average life alone and undisturbed until a cute alien girl crashes into his backyard. By opening up his home, will this otherworldly girl inadvertently open up his heart?
Aww.
Oh. So yeah, this is a very lighthearted romance webtoon. Basically, Cade is like this like ultimate antisocial emo person.
Man after my own heart right there.
He has tattoos, he has gauges in his ear, you know, he's like very like emo. He appears to work at like a store that's like kind of like the approximate of like Spencer's or something.
Amazing.
And Zeta is this adorable, bubbly, kind alien who is interested in learning everything she can about Earth. She left her home planet of Zodia, and even where we're at in the comic now, which is like 50, 60 something episodes in, we still don't know why she left. But you can tell that like there's like something bad going on, that's why she like ran away essentially. I have some theories about what that might be, but I will leave those for now. So yeah, basically this comic is them trying to keep Zeta's identity a secret while also helping her to learn how to blend in like as an Earthling. But at the same time, Zeta is teaching Cade just as much as she's learning basically how to not be a grumpy Gus all the time and how to learn to trust people again after experiencing heartbreak. So this webtoon is so cute and so adorable. Very lighthearted. This is not like a spicy romance webtoon, so you're not going to get a lot of like heavily edited sex scenes or anything in this webtoon, which definitely happens in some other romance webtoons. Like, this is very, yeah, it really does. But this is like very tame in comparison. It's a very slow burn romance too. It's just very adorable. Them like, you know, catching feelings, and but they don't want to tell the other one about it. It's very cutesy. So I highly recommend Down to Earth if you like romance stories and also you just want something that's very like fun and not heavy. This is very different from my last webtoon suggestion, which was Unholy Blood. This is like complete polar opposite in terms of webtoons. So if you're interested in this kind of story, definitely recommend Down to Earth. It's one of my favorites. I don't always like keep 100% up to date with every webtoon I'm subscribed to because I'm subscribed to like 40 or something at this point. I'm subscribed to a lot. But Down to Earth is one of the handful that I do. I read the episode like as soon as it comes out every single week. So I would highly recommend it.
Excellent. It sounds adorable.
It's you can see I'm like, Paige can see, listeners can't see. I'm just like smiling talking about it because I love it so much and I'm so excited about it. So yes, Down to Earth.
Down to Earth. A lighthearted read for whenever you need that.
Yeah, you know, because sometimes you do.
Dude, in the time of COVID, I need that a lot, honestly.
Yeah, fair. Very fair.
Right? It just balances out and makes you happy. And I am in favor of that.
There are a couple of webtoons that I read that are like pretty dark, and like I can't always read them every week. I gotta be honest. I can't.
I get
sometimes
that.
Just like, I'm just gonna take a break for a couple weeks on this one. I think we're ready for some summary.
All right, let's do this again.
Again.
All right, so I quickly Googled the author again this time because I didn't want repeat of Mist of Avalon, and I am happy to report that I came back with no weirdness about K. Arsenault Rivera, who is our author today. I think this is her first book. She is Puerto Rican, living in New York, I think. Yeah, she's living in Brooklyn with her partner. And this is her debut novel. So I will also say that when I was Googling around, I saw, I think it was Martha Wells who does the Murderbot series. Was it Martha Wells? It was one author that I like a lot from the sci-fi side of things who did recommend reading this book. So it's fairly popular in some circles. We'll get into my thoughts.
Yeah.
We'll get into my thoughts.
I was like, some circles.
Some circles. So, this is actually my second read-through of this book, and I have to say it wasn't as good the second time around. There are my thoughts. I forgot that I just led off with this in my
right
script.
Away.
Yep. There's no question about how I feel whenever you're reading this book. It's, it's right out in the open there. Okay, so first time I blew through it, honestly, I read the second book, and it wasn't as good as I wanted it to be, and I never even picked up a copy of the third book, which is already out and has been out for quite some time. And honestly, Not sure if that colored my perception reading it this time around, but there it is. So first thing, this book is written as a letter. Our main characters, Shafali and Shizuka, have been separated for a long time, and Shafali has sent this book-sized letter to Shizuka.
Literally.
Literally.
It is the book.
It is the book. I shit you not when I say.
Can you imagine receiving this, like, manuscript of, like,
right,
400 pages or something?
Hey, babe, I sent you this. Like, mother...
Remember our childhood? I'm going to recount remember it for you our childhood.
That is literally this fucking book.
It just cracks me up.
Do
you remember it? Because I do. Let me tell you.
Let me tell you everything. Yeah, everything that we read, aside from a few short scenes in the middle of the current timeline, is literally Shafali's views on everything that happened in their childhood, which Shizuka was present for most of them. But, yeah. I mean, I guess she's getting all of Shafali's thoughts and feelings about the situation, so perhaps new information, although, frankly, as well as they know each other, it's probably fucking not. It's probably not.
Yeah.
So at this point, we don't know why they're separated. All we know is that Shizuka, who is Empress of the Hokan Empire, throws all of her servants out, cancels all of her appointments for the next couple of days, and generally isn't moving an inch until she reads this letter. It's fucking huge. So this letter opens up by talking about the strange circumstances of their birth. Their mothers are these living legend badasses who have been best friends since they survived being tortured for 8 straight days by a demon general and then ended up killing that general. And to put that in perspective, a team of like 16 went in and only the two of them survived, plus there are only like 4 and now 3 demon generals, so badasses. So they're besties who are pregnant at the same time, so they go and get their fortunes told, as you do. Except no one can tell what Shizuka's fortune is. All the seers will say is that their two girls will be together like 2 pine needles. And sure enough, when both are born, they are born with 2 pine needles stuck to their foreheads. And one of them is born out on the Mongolian steppe. So, like, there's not a fucking tree for miles.
That's just so weird, man. I was like, man, those pine needles were inside the womb this whole time.
Oof.
Just I don't like it.
Developing along. Just in case you weren't sure that this is going to be like some weird child, there's some pine needles for you.
Forget about it, yeah.
So now Shizuka is Hokurin and niece of the emperor. If you want to think of Hokurin, it's sort of like a metaphor for the Chinese empire. So she's niece to the emperor. In fact, she's the only heir, so her birth is kind of a big deal. Also, she was born on the 8th hour of the 8th day of the 8th month, which is associated with a goddess known as the Daughter. This makes her birth even more special. Shafali, on the other hand, is Quarin, a nomadic people, think Mongolians, nomadic steppe herders, or steppe nomads.
Mm.
And her mother is the leader of her people, but she doesn't hold that title because of a peace treaty with the Hokurin, where she was forced to give it up. But Shafali can inherit it, which makes her very special to the Kurin. Also, her birthday matches up with the goddess known as the Grandmother, who is associated with this guy here, so think Tengri, but gender-flipped. They first meet when they are 3 years old, where Shizuka promptly tries to strangle Shafali. So, off to a great start there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see each other again until they are 8, but send letters back and forth. In the meantime, Shafali has been getting the shit kicked out of her by all of her cousins, because on top of giving up her title, Shafali's mom also had to marry a Hokurin noble. So Shafali is of mixed race. And this is brought up a lot. The Hokurin don't like the Kurin because racism, and also Shafali's mom basically would have wrecked them but had to call it quits because her population was so small that further fighting would have just decimated them. But she did blow up their wall in the process, so, like, awesome. The Kurin don't like the Hokurin because who likes being the subject of racism, and also the Hokurin had thrown a bunch of black bloods over the wall to infect them. Now, black bloods are basically humans turned into demons. A bit of their blood gets into your system and you die agonizingly before coming back like a fucking zombie to kill people. So I'm with the Kurin on this one. When the girls are 8, they meet up again when Shafali comes to stay with Shizuka's family and things go a lot smoother, which it was a fucking low bar.
Yeah, very low. Yeah.
Yeah, coulda just baby stepped over that one. Anyway, They basically become inseparable. Now, a few important things happen during this day. First, Shizuka's mom insists on showing the girls what happens when someone is infected with black blood and how to respond, i.e. cutting off their heads. Why is she doing this? That is also a fair question. It's because both girls, but mostly Shizuka, declare that they are going to be warriors. And frankly, I think she was trying to scare them out of it. Second, Shizuka and Shafely become aware that they have powers that others do not. Shizuka has an affinity for flowers. They follow her wherever she moves. She turned them all gold at some point, just royally pissing off her uncle. And she's something of a sword genius. Now, Shafely can speak to horses, always knows the direction north. She can hit a bird the size of someone's fist a couple hundred feet away with her bow and arrow. Shizuka, who has never heard the term modesty before in her life, declares them to be gods. So that's a thing. The last thing that happens is Shizuka decides they're going for a ride in a forest where there are bandits and tigers, and then that they should stay the night. Shafely, who is the practical one, stays up all night on watch, but a tiger appears out of nowhere at dawn. Turning immediately into an 8-year-old badass, she jumps on her horse, shoots the damn thing like 8 times before Shizuka gives it the last blow with her sword. Shafely is hurt pretty bad in the fight, but that heals up in no time because they actually kind of are little gods and have amazing healing abilities. When Shafely's mom comes to pick her up, both Shafely and Shizuka are given adult names. Now, this is pretty important in Korin culture, and it's unusual for an outsider like Shizuka to receive one. Shafely is given the name Barcelai, which means tiger-striped, because she got those claw marks. Shizuka is given the name Barstok, which means tiger thief, which I got a good little laugh out of, honestly. So they spend some time apart again, constantly sending mail back and forth. In this time, Shafely encounters a demon who is killing members of a different group of Korin. Shafely, at the age of 10, sneaks in to help, because 10-year-olds are a handful. We find out that she is the only one who can see the demon, which is terrifying, and during the whole thing, the demon nearly kills her, but her mom comes out of nowhere and decapitates the thing, so she survives. And her mother is pretty pissed, but this is what I meant when I said earlier that only some people could see the demons. So a couple years later, the girls are 13 now. A messenger comes along to tell them that Shizuka's parents are dead and that her mother wanted Shafely's mom to look after Shizuka. Well, Shafely's mom has a bit of a breakdown over this. They were besties. But Shafely immediately jumps on a horse with one guard and rides to wherever Shizuka is, which is in the capital. Shizuka is basically being held prisoner by her uncle, who is the literal worst. Shafely just keeps her company and goes with her to court when her uncle calls while she's there. So while they're at court, some douchebag comes up and starts insulting both Shafely and Shizuka. And Shizuka's like, you can insult me, that's not a big deal. And then he mentions something about Shafely and she's like, we're fucking dueling now, get your sword. So she wins the duel and cuts him right across the face. And the dude is pissed and dragged off by a bunch of guards. Now, I'm not getting into too much detail here, but this dude is slimy. Keep him in mind, he'll be back. Of course. After a couple of days, Shafely's mom comes to get them. She has to cut out a dude's tongue to get Shizuka out, but honestly, that's not as much carnage as there could have been. I mean, she blew up a fucking wall. So Shizuka lives in the steppe with a Korin for 3 years. During this time, she pushes herself really hard to become a better fighter. Towards the end of these 3 years, she starts to get a fever, but keeps training, and then she almost collapses. Luckily, Shafely is there, like she always is, and catches her. The medicine woman can't do anything to help. Shafely's mom is freaking out again and goes off to find a sacred river quite a ways away to get some water that might help. Meanwhile, Shafely takes Shizuka to an empty gur, which is sort of like a yurt, and then they proceed to have sex. Because when you're dying of fever is the best time for this. Now, it seems a little out of nowhere when I'm telling you this, but it's been obvious for a while now in the story that they're both in the more than friends stage, especially when they meet up again when they're 13. But Shizuka literally pulls the I'm not dying until you kiss me move, and things just, like, escalate from there. This was far more descriptive than it needed to be. I will also just say that.
Wait, is this, like, an adult book, or is this supposed to be YA?
I think it's supposed to be an adult, technically.
Okay. I was like, lots of description is a little strange for YA, but
No, by the end of the book, they're like 30. So in book two, they're also about 30. So I think it's meant to be for an older audience. But at this point, you know, listening or reading about two 16-year-olds having fairly graphic sex while one of them is dying of a fever is like...
so uncomfortable.
This was not on my to-do list.
Yeah, that's uncomfortable.
So she doesn't die. I know you're shocked. Weren't we all? She's totally fine by morning. When she wakes up, the sun tells her to go north. Another one of her superpowers. So she and Shafali pack up some stuff and head on a 2-month trip to the Wall of Flowers, which separates the territory of the demons from the territory of the humans. Now, the wall was created by the daughter and is literally made out of flowers, so not just a clever name. Well, it turns out there's another demon hanging around, because of course there fucking is. Shizuka nearly charges in, but Shafali makes her put on a suit of armor so she's protected from any blood that gets on her, which is fucking smart. Yep. She doesn't take one, because she's an archer and she won't be that close, right? No. Fucking wrong.
No.
Fucking wrong. Shafali isn't a big fan of this plan anyway, but follows along, because that's just kind of what she does. And while they kill the demon, Shafali gets a huge dose of demon blood into an open wound. And so starts Shafali's living hell. She survives, which no one has ever done before, but she's changed. She heals even faster than she already did. She has super strength, and she has a temper to match. Oh, and random demons keep appearing that nobody else can see, apparently whispering terrible things to her that makes her question her sanity. Good times. Well, luckily for her, her mom came to get them. So Shizuka and Shafali travel with her mom for a bit until they come to a village where Shizuka suggests they buy supplies. LOL, bandits have taken the town and corralled all of the people into a bathhouse where they are killing them all. So Shizuka comes up with a shitty plan of me and Shafali will run in and these two guards who are with us can guard the exit. So Shizuka gets stabbed and then Shafali loses her shit. She rips 10 people apart and changes physically. So now she has claws, she has sharpened teeth, she's looking way more demon-like. Also, now that she's changed, she can't hide the whole I'm a demon thing from her mom, which she had been doing up until that point.
Yikes.
Well, her mom exiles her until she can control herself because you can't let crazy loose on your people. So Shizuka and Shafali start traveling south to where Shafali's brother, who has grown up Hokurin, lives. On the way, they run into another group of bandits and pretty much the same thing happens, except Shafali's eyes start glowing and her jaw comes unhinged at that point. So cool. Also, she completely loses her fucking mind and almost kills Shizuka by strangling her. Parallels. It's
poetic justice, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So
karma something.
Something. Something is going on here. Shafali feels bad about this, obviously, and almost kills herself over it, but Shizuka is actually much more calm about it, basically calling it fair for the time that she almost strangled Shafali. So, true love.
Oh, God. Okay.
They continue their travels south, but along the way they stop at temples and other places to try and find a cure. Surprise, there isn't one. But finally they get south, where Shafali's brother, Kenshiro, lives with his new wife, Baojai, who are both surprisingly cool with the whole demon thing. They stay there for a while, happily recovering from the shit show of the past couple months, when a letter from the Emperor comes. He has been searching for Shizuka so that he can marry her off and therefore control her. Kenshiro, being a shitty brother, let the Emperor know where Shizuka was, so he is on his way with the entire court. Even his wife stops talking to him over this one. The letter says that anyone who beats Shizuka in a duel can marry her. And so suitors come one after the other to duel her, and she beats their asses. Until the same dude who dueled her when she was 13 shows up. Re-enter Slimeball. And this deeply pisses off Shizuka and Shafali. Shizuka had pretty much beaten this guy in her sleep last time around, but this time he actually slices her ear off. It shouldn't surprise you that this triggers another of Shafali's little demon transformations, except by this time, the entire court, including the Emperor, is there to witness it. So this goes over poorly, and everyone is screaming to kill Shafali, except she's a bit preoccupied with this dude because there is something wrong with him. And by this, I mean he's possessed by a demon. LOL, why was I not surprised by this? Just fucking demons showing up everywhere. So Shafali is trying to take this guy out, and in the process, she loses an eye. So this is kind of interesting, because all of the demons she's met so far have called her Steel Eye, which she always recognized as her name and as a correct and proper name for her, but her eyes were fine. Just keep that Steel Eye thing in mind for a minute, because we'll get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
So she rips this demon's head off, so everyone is kind of caught up with why she was freaking out now, so everyone's on the same page. And after that, she passes out. She wakes up and notices that the transformation has gotten worse again. She now has gray skin and white hair, and she's covered in black veins. To her credit, Shizuka doesn't seem to have a problem with this, so there's that. And that's when a guard comes in with some manacles, which he does admit is hilariously useless, to take her to the Emperor for judgment. Well, Shizuka says, fuck that. So she asks the guard if they can stop in the temple to pray, which he grudgingly lets them do. Psych! Shizuka actually convinces the priest in there to marry them. Apparently, same-sex marriages were allowed in this province previously, as this particular territory used to be an independent country that didn't have any problems with such things. Hokuru, not so much. So literally, no one is expecting this, which kind of makes it better.
Hmm, yeah.
But it's important because a member of the royal family cannot be executed, so Shizuka is outsmarting her uncle there. Well, after this, they go into the chamber where the emperor is waiting, and they're like, we're married, you can't kill her, mic drop. But the emperor is a first-rate asshole, so after a mini temper tantrum, he sends Shafali on a quest, which is basically just a sort of exile. She cannot come back until she has a phoenix's feather, and as you can imagine, that's fucking hard to do. So he thought he won. Shafali was taken away and escorted to the border of Hokuru and another country. Along the way, Kenshiro, the brother, catches up with her with a present from Shizuka. It's her short sword, but melted down into a new eye for the one that she lost. So now she really is Steel Eye.
Hmm. That sounds like a fucking terrible material to make an eye out of. I'm not gonna lie.
You're not wrong, but apparently it works really well for her. And towards the end of the book, or beginning of the second one, I can't remember where the divide is, she starts growing those black veins over the eye. So it basically just literally incorporates it into that. She's like, I can almost kind of like see out of it sometimes too. So her demon blood is digging that.
That's fucking gross, man. Okay.
So also, one of the emperor's wives is from a country that, one, doesn't discriminate against same-sex marriages, and two, has a phoenix somewhere that her brother is tracking down. So she passes along this info to Shafali because she is a good aunt. This brother is a merchant prince from Shirshar. And wouldn't you know it, one of the meetings that Shizuka had canceled to read this letter was from a merchant prince of Shirshar. Which brings us back to the present timeline. Shizuka basically loses her fucking mind, sending people to go get the prince and his party, and guess who's there carrying a phoenix feather?
I feel like this is a moment where I should go like, aw, but nothing about that story has inspired any of those feelings in me, so.
Fair enough.
Hey, Shafali's there.
Yay, Shafali has come back to a really unfortunate relationship. Anyway, that's where this book ends, and it picks up in the book The Phoenix Empress, which is Shizuka telling the story of what happened since they had been separated.
Clearly she's empress now and not like her uncle is an emperor, so.
At the time that book starts, her uncle is there, but yeah, she ends up deposing him. Spoiler alert, I'm gonna ruin the second book. She, like, deposes him and throws him into prison, and then she's like, I'm the empress now, fuck you.
That sounds good.
And everyone is okay with it.
And no one has a problem.
And no one is upset because her uncle's the fucking worst. Anyway.
All right.
That's the end. Let's go to Creative's Corner.
Let's do it. Alright, so for Creative's Corner, several months after I had originally intended for us to talk about this, my Creative's account for this week is Goodbooks ATL. Goodbooks ATL, it's an account on Instagram that we follow and that I really enjoy following. Catherine and Katie are a mother-daughter team running a pop-up and online bookstore focusing on blackness. I first ran across this account on Instagram, like I mentioned, I think from a post on Well-Read Black Girls page, which is another Instagram account that we follow. I think as someone who works with rare books, the fact that they feature so many vintage editions of the works of Black authors is just really appealing to me. It is all very like bespoke, and they don't preference only well-known works either. Like there's a lot of like deep pick kind of stuff. The other really cool service they offer is custom curations. So you give them a price point and an author or genre or subject, and they'll send some picks your way. Being able to create lists to fit someone's interest just seems like such an arcane art to me. I feel like you have to be incredibly well-read to do it well. And I experience a lot of anxiety when people ask me for book recommendations, which is hilarious because I literally do this. Like, that's what we fucking do.
Yep.
But I experience a lot of anxiety doing that. So basically, I admire them for making this part of their business. Anyway, it's just a very cool Instagram account and shop. And I actually ended up getting a curation from them back in March. I want to say March. Mm. So I ended up getting like science fiction by Black authors. So I got two compilations of Octavia Butler, and then I got another book whose title and author are escaping me right now, but I can link it in the show notes for this episode too. So yeah, I was really overall very happy with that experience, and I would definitely recommend Good Books ATL if that sounds like something you're interested in, curations, or you want to read more works by Black authors. This is a great account to check out for that.
Awesome.
And that's Creative's Corner.
Yay. I'm a fan of this. I like this a lot. All right. You ready to discuss?
Let's do it.
All right. All right. So we're going to start these discussion questions with a lob.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you ever read anything with a Mongolian influence?
Yeah, that was just a resounding no for me the first time. It is still a resounding no for me now. Even just like Asian influence in general, I haven't read a ton of, which this month is AAPI month. So particularly good, not the only time of the year that you should look for Asian authors, but a particularly good time of the year to look for Asian authors. But no, nothing of Mongolian influence.
Yeah, me either. I mean, I've read some nonfiction stuff about Mongols because
they're really important. History.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're really medieval important. History. We need to know these things. But as far as fiction goes, I don't even think that I could tell you about anyone that I knew, much less read.
Yeah.
Across any of the subjects that I read.
No. Yeah, I got nothing. Got nothing. Mongols.
I got nothing. If you have any suggestions, please let us know, because I feel like this could be a really, really awesome topic. Would love to read, especially science fiction and fantasy with Mongolian influence. I feel like that would be badass.
Yeah, it sounds really cool.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so question number two, and I think it's going to be really obvious that I don't particularly care for this relationship, but what do you think about Shizuka and Shafley's relationship from the little that I told you here?
Yeah, I feel like I had a really long and detailed response to this in our first recording, and I just don't have that today. Basically, I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't think it's a good relationship. I distinctly remember talking about this last time. Shafley just has like such a passive role in this relationship, and Shizuka, to me, doesn't really deserve the commitment and loyalty of Shafley, given that Shizuka seems to have no problem just putting Shafley in danger and ruining her life, basically, because she gets demon blood in her, and now she's like part demon or whatever the fuck she is, and that's like Shizuka's fault. So yeah, I think it's pretty shitty. I don't like these relationship dynamics at all.
Yeah. If it wasn't obvious from my summary, I don't particularly care for it either, largely because Shizuka just has this, overblown perception of what she is capable of. And she's got good reason to think that she can do a lot because of all of her powers and her healing abilities. But she just sort of disregards Shafuli's safety when she's doing this because she doesn't ever fucking think about what she's doing.
Yeah.
She just runs straight into any danger, which continues to be a problem in the next book until her cousin dies.
No, not about it.
No.
Not about it.
I just feel like Shafuli deserved better because she seems just like a genuinely good person.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I agree. Yeah. I think it's trash.
This relationship is trash.
Yeah, not like I'm not like saying the book is trash. I just think the relationship is just not good. It's just not good.
It's not, and that kind of like bums me out because I really wanted to have like a super awesome Eastern culture inspired fantasy pick that I could read and like be very happy with it. And at first I was very happy with it, and then I wasn't.
Then
wasn't
happy with it anymore.
Yeah. Then I read it again, and the disappointment is real. Anyway, that's all I got. I think you have a question in here, though.
Yeah, so when I was intrigued when you first picked this book because it was clearly like an Asian-inspired fantasy, but it was being written by someone who is not Asian. Like you mentioned before, K. Arsenault Rivera is Puerto Rican. So I just figured I would go on Goodreads and look at the reviews. And I found some, well, they're very critical reviews. They're very critical reviews. One of them specifically addressing the very questionable culturally appropriative choices that Rivera was making in writing this book. And then the other one's just kind of just trashing, like, just the book in general. But I was curious as to what your thoughts on these critiques were and whether or not you agreed with them or saw that they had a point or if you, you know, disagreed with them.
Okay, so I am opening up the first one. And the first thing that it is pointing out
It gets into a lot of the details of the use of language, since apparently Rivera borrowed really heavily from Japanese language for much of this book, and also the use of racial stereotypes.
And racial slurs, apparently.
Yes.
There is one rice eater versus rice tongue, which, yeah, I do see how that is extremely problematic. I don't remember how it was used in the book. I think it's meant to show a certain amount of racism, which is prevalent in this book between especially the Kuren and the Hokuren. Been a couple months since I read this book. I don't remember how it was used
right
now, but yeah, I 100% agree that that can be very problematic.
Yeah, I think I remember this reminded me the first time that we were going into recording, it reminded me of reading Woven in Moonlight and some of the critiques that were leveled against that with the use of racial stereotypes towards indigenous peoples. And that book was also deeply based in. So the narrative in Woven in Moonlight, like racism is a huge theme in Woven in Moonlight is what I'm trying to say. And so I was like, well, it makes sense that they would include racial stereotypes. But in both of these cases, people still had critiques with how they were being used. And I think in the case of The Tiger's Daughter, the first review that I have linked, which will appear in the show notes, was talking about how these racial stereotypes were being used from the character's perspective who was being racially stereotyped. So it was Shafuli who was describing herself with these terms.
Mm.
Even if, like, she was perhaps referencing the racism that she experienced, the reviewer was arguing that as a Japanese person herself, she would never have described herself in those terms. So it was like a subtle, you know, it was like Rivera was like trying to demonstrate racism, but doing it in a way that some people didn't agree with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a fair assessment. I'm trying to go down more
there's,
of this.
There's a lot in this review.
There's a lot. It's
this
a
reviewer
lot of,
was not happy. There's a lot of like specific language stuff.
It is a lot of specific language stuff where you have a lot of Chinese aspects that are labeled with a Japanese sort of term or is it seems like, or aesthetic.
Well, apparently Rivera was basing this off of Japanese history and culture in a lot of instances.
Did not read like Japanese.
And, well, like so for example, the Hokurin is based off of like Hokkaido, which is an island in Japan. Not really very, just pretty transparent there. At least that's what the reviewer points out. Obviously, I didn't read the book, so like I have no idea. The reviewer also made an interesting point, which connects back to a different author that also has gotten some criticism for this. And she talks about how Rivera's appreciation for Japanese culture and other Asian cultures is very superficial and based off of basically an appreciation for anime.
She does.
And because apparently Rivera's own website is like, and Twitter page and stuff, it's like a lot of anime. And she's basically saying that like you can't base an entire book, you can't base your understanding of a culture off of anime. And that reminds me a lot of the critiques that have been leveled against Jay Kristoff, who wrote the Nevernight series and had made some really kind of like flippant remarks about how he prepared for the book was watching a bunch of anime. And so, yeah, that kind of reminds me. It's just interesting that, like, when you're not writing within your own culture, you have to be, like, I think particularly careful. It seems that perhaps Rivera has not as deep of an understanding of these cultures as maybe she thought she did.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like that. I mean, I don't know if she was just trying to, like, make a blend of cultures to create sort of a fantasy setting one, or if she just utterly failed in her knowledge of what she's doing. It's sort of hard to tell. I would probably say she thought she knew more than what she was doing.
Yeah.
And certainly this reviewer thought so. And yeah, I can't fault her for those opinions at all. The reviewer, that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's take a look at the second one. It's a little bit better organized, so we can hit point by point on this one.
Yeah, there are larger themes being addressed.
Yes.
In this one, yeah.
So, okay, we have much of the plot is waylaid by repeating info dumps of the author's world-building notes in the place of actual storytelling. Accurate. That does happen. Spent an entire time reading in a state of incredulity in regards to the ages of the two characters. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. I was, like, thinking that as you were reading your summary. I was like, they're eight?
They're eight? Yep. Yeah, they just get to go out in a forest when they're 8 years old. That's apparently what happens.
Yeah. And kill a tiger.
And kill a tiger. Most people rarely, if ever, have found their true loves at 10 years old. Yeah.
Fair. Yeah, fair.
I wanted much more plot than we get in this book. This needed balancing between romance and fantasy plot movement. Yeah, this did get heavy on the romance in a lot of places, especially since it's coming as a letter from Schaefeli to Shizuka. Like, it makes sense that it falls more on the romance side than the plot side, but...
Right.
I fully agree with this.
But it's having to read through it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Give me some more action. What sort of friend sends an entire novel to their childhood romantic interest, retelling all of the experiences that she was there for the majority of? I think we've already addressed that.
I think we covered that. I just remember the first time we recorded, I didn't know it was a letter. And like, I mean, you mentioned it at the beginning, but I didn't think the entire thing was a letter.
There's like two, like 5-page chapters, which takes you out of the letter and back to where Shizuka is. And it's basically her just like telling people to bring her more wine because she's a fucking alcoholic.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So she grows up to be an alcoholic, in case you were wondering.
I mean, like, that's not terribly surprising given what she's experienced so far in her life, but yikes.
Yep. It's a feel-good book. It's not a feel-good book. There are also a number of complaints I've read from other reviewers better suited than I am to address the issue about a concern of the author lifting too much from Japanese and Mongolian cultures to create her own.
Which, yeah. I think they link to the first review that I linked.
Yes, and I will also say that that reviewer is in a better position to say that than I am as a white person, so I will bow to their expertise in this area.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they say that they have, that Rivera has lifted too much, then they have lifted too much.
Yeah.
That's actually withholding a starred review, as I didn't actually complete the book. I did complete the book twice, actually. So I can definitively say I do not like this book.
It's a strong statement.
Yeah. 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 And again, that's just super disappointing because I really want an excellent, top-tier, Eastern-inspired fantasy novel. I get all of this from my Western cultures. I have plenty to choose from Norse mythology and, except for Irish. Nobody apparently wants to do the Irish mythology.
Apparently
but,
not, yeah.
Apparently not. I'm still pissed about that. But I would also like one from the Eastern perspective. And I was hoping that this was going to be it. It comes highly recommended. It comes recommended from authors that I love. And it sucked.
I feel like, especially with this being AAPI month and a lot of bookstagrammers making a lot of Asian author recommendations, I feel like we can probably try and find something for you in this regard.
Thank God.
But I have to say, I can't think of anything right off the top of my head. Well, particularly something that's written by an author of color rather than a white person. Because I think it's actually not that hard to find Asian-inspired fantasy that's written by white people or other people who are not of Asian descent.
Agreed.
Because a lot of people like to play around in like the Asian world, and it's like, well, that's great, but it does require like a certain amount of cultural understanding, and then also employing like sensitivity readers, which it seems like perhaps this book did not. So.
It doesn't sound like it. So I've also read one and like a quarter of a book of Jay Kristoff's series. The one's got like Storm Dancer or something like that is the first book.
Yeah. I think that actually was the book, the series that he specifically said the anime reference to. The Nevernight series is a different series, I'm pretty sure.
Well, the anime comes through and I would also not recommend that one. That's another, like, early book that I DNF'd it back when I did not DNF books. So, like,
yeah.
If that says anything about what I thought about the second one, like, there's that. There's another book series that's, like, it comes in three sets of three. The first one's, like, White Tiger, Blue Dragon, Red Phoenix. And it's by an Australian woman whose name is, like, something Chen. I think she's of Chinese descent but lives in Australia.
Oh, I do have recommendations for you. Okay, the series...
Don't read that book series was what I was going to finish up with. Twilight. Okay. It's like Twilight in China. Carry on.
Yikes. Okay. Yeah, we don't... Did we need more of that? I don't know.
I don't think we did. We didn't. And yet I still read it. It was a trash read and I read it.
So, The Poppy War?
I have read the first book in The Poppy War. I need to finish that one. Poppy War was great. I will have to say that. That is also not a feel-good book, though.
No, it is not. It's really not. I remember seeing some reviews for it that kind of gave a lot of detail because I haven't read it either. And it was not happy. But a lot of people rave about that series. And I'm pretty sure the third one is out now.
Yeah, it just came out not too long ago, and Twitter fucking exploded largely asking for the author to pay for the therapy that she has inflicted on for all of their feelings, which I feel like I will 100% be in that camp just after the first one. It's really good, but yeah, it takes place in like the opioid wars. So it's going to break your heart, but it was really good. I do need to finish that series. That's a good call.
I know people also really like These Violent Delights. That's not quite like the same. It is, I think it's fantasy. It's like set in like, I think 1920s Hong Kong. And it's actually like a Romeo and Juliet retelling, but like with magic and in Hong Kong. So a lot of people have been going really crazy about that. It's not quite a similar pick to The Tiger's Daughter in terms of time frame and all that, but...
That's all right.
Might be something you're interested in. I'm not a huge fan of Shakespeare. Wow. Okay, that's a big statement. I'm not a huge fan of Shakespeare. Shakespeare retellings, not really my thing. And so I started reading it and I didn't really enjoy it. But I intend to try and finish it at some point. I think it does a very good job of capturing like the atmosphere of 1920s Hong Kong, and there's like gangs, and it's interesting.
That sounds cool.
So might also be worth a read.
I'll check that out. That sounds good. Good one, Jennifer.
Yay. My brain came through for me. Not immediately, but
You know what? It got there, and that's all that matters.
It got there. I was like, in the back of my head, I was like, I could have sworn I like kind of know some. I feel like there's also another series that I'm completely blanking on right now, and I'm going to think of it as soon as we stop recording. And it's going to make me angry, but we can leave it there for now.
All right. I think that that's all I got. This is a fairly short episode for us.
It is. Yeah. The Tiger's Daughter. We're wrapping it up.
2 out of 5.
Yeah. don't necessarily recommend.
Don't necessarily recommend. There are better options.
And on that note, thank you for listening to our very last episode of season 3. We will be releasing information about what we're doing in season 4. Given changing life circumstances, we are going to be making some changes to how we do the podcast. So make sure you are following us on social media. We have an Instagram and a Twitter where we will be posting updates on what exactly is happening for season 4, and also potentially giving you an opportunity to vote on what our theme for season 4 is going to be as well. So make sure you are following us on social media to stay up with all the latest. You can also check out our website, bigbookenergy.com. That is where we are posting our series of Nebula nominee reviews. This month, I think we are doing The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin. Very exciting about that. I still have to read it. So I have about a week. I can do this. but that is where we are posting our series of reviews. So make sure to check out our website as well. And if you are interested in purchasing any or almost all of the books that we talk about in the podcast, there are a couple of exceptions. You can always head on over to our bookshop store, bookshop.org/shop/bigbookenergy. So you'll be getting an awesome book, supporting the podcast, and supporting independent booksellers all at the same time.
And we also have a Patreon if you'd like to support us that way. We have a few tiers available for you to choose from. If you are either a ninja or a mage, you will get access to our very long bonus episodes. This season, we were doing Phone a Friend. The last bonus episode of the season will already be out by the time this one is officially published. So if any of those sound interesting to you, we have been having great conversations with people we're bringing on for a single episode. Head on over to patreon.com/bigbookenergy and pick one of those tiers out for you.
All right, guys, thanks for listening, and we will see you in season 4. Bye.
Bye. Peoples and is still practiced in modern day Mongolia, Turkey, Russia, China, Kazakhstan, and
Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan, thank you.
I don't know if that's pronouncing it correctly, but
honestly, I just looked at it and was like, I got nothing.
Nothing.